Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Kent Daniel Bankowski, and you're listening to the Controversy Tapes podcast number 39. Today's date is Monday, March 17th, 2008. This evening, we're going to talk about two things. The first thing is that I would like to comment on is the fantastic response that I received from last week's podcast featuring a conversation between myself and my good friend Leo Zagani. Leo, as many of you know from listening to the podcast, the Controversy Tapes, have heard that Leo was arrested by Norwegian police recently. This was upon betrayal from his wife, Fatma Susla, and Leo is in dire straits because of it. During the past week, I've received over 200 supportive emails for Leo, and in that same time period, I received about 6 very rude anti-Leo messages. I would like to read a few of the representative comments that I received in the past week. So, without any further ado, this one is from Paul. "Hi, Kent. Our mutual friend has been having quite the time. As a personal testament, I talked to him on the phone for approximately 2 hours last week about his situation and the ongoing correspondence for the past couple of years. Leo, I feel, and he would be one to admit this himself, has been misguided, haven't we all at some point, with people and groups, but Leo is not a betrayer of the cause. I feel his idealism, and certainly the world needs more of this, blinds him sometimes and probably got him kicked out of the Black Brotherhood to begin with. Now what's needed is the so-called movement is to give him as much support as possible, especially since he's been such a wellspring of inside information on how these networks really work. Mistakes are made, but judgment should only be given when enough evidence is presented and the person avoids the questions of that evidence. He did a very good job at defending himself and admitting his errors on the Arctic Beacon show with Greg Szymanski and Eric Phelps. Their Summon the Truth movement, who would not put themselves under this scrutiny. I'm relaying this to you because I feel the man is feeling very isolated right now, and I know with him being an Italian, talking is therapy. So please have him on your show and urge others to do likewise. I don't know if he's mentioned me to you, but I've been trying to get him here to New York for some time, and he has indicated to me that he would like to come reside in the United States, and maybe we can start making that happen. Sincerely, Paul." Paul, Leo and I talked about him coming to the United States. I told him that I lived near Niagara Falls, and if he ever wanted to come and see the falls as a tourist, or just stop by on his way through, or perhaps even move here, that he's fully welcome to do so, and he may stay at my home for free. I extend this invitation to all my friends, and Leo is certainly among them. The second piece of listener feedback that we have is of the following message was posted by one of the members of the Forum on Conspiracy Central. And this person writes, Well, I'd like to comment on Leo being an agent. I guess I can go public with one fact now. Since right before Christmas 2006, I've been in the Oslo Committee of Hope. So I've met with him many times since then, and I didn't know him except for a brief hello hi meeting before the committee started its meetings. And I can attest to one thing with 100% certainty: he is not an agent. I've never observed him to do one malevolent thing, and in our meetings he has mostly been really cheerful, joking about the one-eyed conspiracy, for example. He's simply not exhibited any of the behavior I'd expect from an agent, and believe me, I've been watching. I was somewhat skeptical about him before I got to know him better. Also, I can attest to the committee having been a really democratic open forum, so to speak, and we actually achieved close to a perfect dynamic for an organization concerned with these subjects, because it's essential to sometimes agree to disagree instead of blowing our differences out of proportions, and we managed to do that most of the time. To really nail the fact that this post is an honest one, I can also add that I feel we lacked some organizational direction and structure. We did get some things accomplished, but not really in the sense that we did time on the battlefield. More like making some connections with people in meetings, going to a lecture or two, as well as lively discussion, of course. You know, that sort of thing. Finally, maybe Leo is even a little loopy at times, but he's always been lucid, clear, and coherent when I've been around him, though. Or maybe it's just more of an eccentricity. If you read about his disc jockey past, it soon becomes clear that he's been a little unconventional and something of an original for a long, long time. However, despite that, he's not out of touch with reality, and he does see the conspiracy very correctly as far as anything I've heard him say. In this case, an enemy of my enemy is my friend. He's not malevolent, and the initiative he took is something I see as really needed, the goal being something of a popular uprising against the New World Order. Even if now it looks a little bleak for the future for the Committee of Hope and for the continuation of the work Leo's done so far. I'd also like to add the following link, especially after hearing the recorded interview Leo did with Kent from Kentroversy. That Leo does sound genuinely depressed and completely taken aback by the situation he finds himself in. I'm surprised, really, at how he manages to pull himself together that relatively well and remain lucid and intelligible during the radio interviews he has given over the past couple of difficult days. I really have to commend Leo for his bravery and steadfastness in staying true to himself and to the things he believes in, especially upon realizing the magnitude of the losses he suffered these past few weeks. This fact alone is enough for me to believe Leo is genuine in his efforts and aims, and so he earns my deepest sympathy and support in the trying times he's now going through. That's all I have to say for now. Thank you, Phil. Phil, thank you for your feedback. Leo definitely appreciates hearing from his brothers from the Committee of Hope, and he's going to be looking to create a Committee of Hope structure across the entire United States. And finally, I would like to read a message from Leo himself. Leo wanted me to read this to everyone. Thank you for your continuous support, and please forgive me if I could not reply earlier, but as you know, they confiscated all my computers and mobile phones, and the nearest internet cafe is more than an hour away from where I live in the Oslo suburbs. On the coming Monday, I will finally be able to check the proceedings of the case with my lawyer and the false accusations placed against me by my wife after her sudden betrayal. But my lawyer told me today that she doesn't seem to have a strong case against me, as she does not have at the moment any eyewitnesses that can support her outrageous claims of abuse and manipulation from my side. Obviously, this could change in the next few months. They could bring in some corrupt witness into the picture so they could screw me over like Fritz Springmeier. But at the moment, it's her word against mine. Even if Fatma Suslu stated to Greg at Arctic Beacon and elsewhere on the net quite a different story, a false and insulting tale made up of my supposed violence against her and the kids, total rubbish, and many witnesses on her side, another lie. While my conscience is clear, my friends, as I've always been a good and honest family man, a husband deeply in love with my wife and totally dedicated to my children, who should never go through such a terrible experience. I say children because this includes also the child from her previous marriage called Zachariah, who I consider to be my child. The Norwegian kingdom and the Norwegian police have, in any case, already acted illegally against me, abusing their power with my forced arrest on the 4th of March, 2008, as also stated by my lawyer, who is furious with the police authorities of this country for their abuse of power. The Norwegian police love this insane New World Order agenda, and their Turkish brothers from the Fethullah Gulen movement, a right-wing movement secretly manipulated by the CIA and the Vatican Illuminati, including Jesuits like Thomas Michel, and spiritually driven by the most corrupt descendants of Prophet Muhammad, said Sikh families like the Suslu family of my wife, who think of themselves as the elite of the Illuminati, people that think they have a right to a special reserved place in heaven and the right to act as they wish above the law, even in Western countries like Norway, thanks to the support of the usual suspects. I don't want my son to grow up brainwashed by the Gulen movement and their insane New World Order ideology. I want Isaac Rumi Zaghami to be a free and honest man who respects and loves his father, and I don't want Isaac to become a Muslim fundamentalist who hates me and thinks I'm the Dajjal, which means Muslim Antichrist. So I will try in any way possible to get the court's permission to see my son regularly. In this way, they cannot ruin him completely with their false Muslim ideology. I also received a very interesting email a couple of days ago from a politician in the same party as my wife, Fatma Suslu, the Norwegian Socialist Party called SV. She told me that my wife has been working for the government for a long time on various projects and wanted to warn me earlier about her dishonest intentions toward me, but felt it was dangerous to tell me anything about it at that time. I really don't know if I can trust this politician, but he does seem honest and has been involved recently with a disclosure project for my friends at Project Camelot in the U.S., and I know for a fact that my wife has been working recently on a project with the government for the establishment of a cultural center owned by Norwegian Freemasons, a place which should also be connected to future research in so-called ecologically friendly activities. Fatma got involved in this project with certain Anne thanks to an English right-wing Freemason called Jonathan Boulter, B-O-U-L-T-E-R, who used to be working with me when I was in the Monte Carlo P2 Lodge. I warned my wife that what she was doing by working with these people was wrong, but she didn't listen to me. My wife has been unfortunately brainwashed against me by the Fethullah Gulen movement, which is a sectarian version of Islam close to the Jesuits, and some people in the Norwegian political and Masonic establishment who obviously advised my wife to distance herself ASAP from me and my anti-New World Order position if she wanted to get back in their evil and sick political game. And Fatma unfortunately wants to be a politician again. It's very hard, as you can imagine, to confront the fact that the mother of your only child is actually working for your enemy and even sending you to prison as your birthday gift. But I will have to survive this difficult moment in every way possible. And even after all this, I'm still very much in love with Fatma, but that's because I'm quite sure she was forced to betray me in this way with the police, and she is probably already regretting the moment she left me for their new privileged position in the Muslim Illuminati establishment. The situation is, in any case, very difficult for me, as I am in great danger in this corrupt country of Norway now that my only protection, the Gulen movement, has betrayed me and put me in the hands of the Freemasonic enemy of the Swedish Rite that have already persecuted me in the past. So my intentions are to leave Europe altogether as soon as possible, and join my supporters in the USA, where we're finally going to start my tour of hope and my new anti-New World Order project against the sick Illuminati bastards that have ruined my life over and over again. Committees of Hope will start gathering all over the United States in the next few months under my presence, and many important things will happen. So I want to thank already my friends and my supporters in the United States who are giving me the possibility to start a new life in a safe and protected way after such a horrible experience. No problem. The Illuminati managed to get their black magic working against me and my wife and successfully destroyed my family. They really didn't like my happy little family, unfortunately. But I'm not a dead man yet, and I'm sure that one day my wife will realize that she was only the innocent tool of the dark side, and she should have been praying and protecting herself more and more from these evil jinns that are now controlling her. Keep me in your prayers, and if God wants, I will soon be visiting you. If not, don't let my message die, and keep the Illuminati resistance alive as my future remains uncertain. Leo Lion Zagami. Wow. What a statement by Leo. But anyway, that brings us up to date on last week's podcast. Thank you, everybody, for your feedback on the controversytapes.net website. And thank you very much, even for the negative comments that I've received. Tonight, however, we're going to have a short talk with my other good friend, Michael Tesarian, who is the author of the brand new books entitled The Irish Origins of Civilization. And unfortunately, some of the interview got destroyed and could not be used because of technical difficulties. But with that being said, I preserved as much of the interview as I possibly could, which now commences. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to my comments. And stay informed and tell the truth. Thank you. This evening, we have Michael Tesarian, an occult expert and divination scholar. Michael is quite an amazing person, and he has many websites filled with a tremendous amount of information. Michael was born in Northern Ireland, and he's an expert on the occult histories of Ireland and America. He has made the deepest research into Atlantis, the origins of evil, and now with his brand new book, The Irish Origins of Civilization, which is quite an amazing story, and it puts to rest some of the lies that we've been told through our history books. He's the author of the acclaimed book, Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, and is the producer and presenter of the phenomenal Origins and Oracles DVD series, which is 22 DVDs, which lasts 60 hours of the most amazing information that I've ever witnessed, and it explores everything from the ancient mysteries to forbidden knowledge. You can visit Michael and his information at michaeltesarian.com, and that's Michael, Tesarion.com. So with that being said, Michael, welcome to the Controversy Tapes.
Thanks, Kent. Thanks for having me back on. Glad to be here.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to a very interesting talk this evening. And tonight I'd like to talk about your DVDs and also the new book that you just wrote.
Sure, be glad to.
Okay, great. So let's begin with When was it that you discovered the truth about historical Ireland?
Well, that started in 1979.
Uh-huh.
I was in art class in Ireland, you know, as we say, skiving off. Actually, the art teacher was the head of the faculty, so he never actually used to come into the class. So, because he was always busy, and he was actually one of the better teachers in this totally sadistic, you know, Dickensian type of schooling that I was exposed to. I didn't do any work. I was totally introverted and, you know, utterly, you know, the worst student you can ever imagine, you know. And the art teacher had a book on his table that was by a guy called Jim Fitzpatrick, and it was a very highly illustrated book on Celtic Ireland. And, you know, this was actually ostensibly a Protestant school, and therefore a book like that normally would never have even entered into the, you know, the grounds of the school, let alone the building itself. It was only because it was an art book. It was a book that was full of beautiful paintings, and it was a sort of a, you know, a vogue thing at the time. So the art teacher had the book purely because it was a book of art, not because of the text or necessarily what it was about, you know, because that would have been totally taboo.
Right,
and,
right.
And absolutely taboo. And basically, now the artist himself, you see, Jim Fitzpatrick, who kindly, I know him now, and he kindly actually has allowed me to use several pictures from that book in my book. I mean, completely free, and he gave me the rights to do that, you know, and tremendous support from him. It was a beautiful thing, in fact, to get the Irish Origins book done, because I meant it in a way as an homage to this guy that back in 1979, his book got me started. So it's almost like with this year, the publishing of the Irish Origins book for me is a huge full circle. But
sure.
I had no idea. I had no idea who this guy was. And it turns out he's actually extremely famous. You know, he's the designer of the famous image of Che Guevara, the Cuban revolutionary, you know, that everyone wears, the one where it's like almost like the Andy Warhol style.
Yeah.
You know, with
yeah.
Che wearing the famous, you know, the beret. That's actually a Jim Fitzpatrick image.
Wow, I didn't know
yeah.
that.
That's right. And he also is a, he used to be the designer for all the covers of the heavy metal band Thin Lizzy.
Oh, no kidding.
So people who are listening to us right now could actually have Jim Fitzpatrick's artwork right in their house and not know it. He designed, I think, 9 out of 10 of if not all, of their album covers. And he was a very, very close friend of Phil Lynott, the lead singer for Thin Lizzy. And, of course, me, myself, being into that kind of music, I mean, that was just doubly interesting, you know, to sort of shake hands, so to speak, with Jim, because we'd already known him through the great artwork that he had done. And, you know, I had no idea that he was also, like Phil Lynott, deeply involved in the traditions, let's call it Celtic for just sake of language right now, just to use a word. They are deeply involved in the history of Ireland on a Celtic, from a Celtic point of view. And of course, if people really know about the band Thin Lizzy, they'll know what I'm talking about, because the band released probably their greatest album, which is called The Black Rose, Roisin Dubh, which actually features songs about ancient Celtic, ancient Irish legends, you know, beautifully composed. A very great album, and Jim Fitzpatrick did the magnificent cover to that, you know. So here's this guy's book sitting on our art teacher's table, and I wasn't even noticing it. It was a friend of mine beside me. In Ireland, they seat you based on your name, you see. So the guy, the first letter of the name is the guy you sit beside, you know, the second name.
Yeah.
So the guy was sitting beside me, goes, "Hey, have you ever read that book?" And of course, you know, I said, "No, whatever." You know, we leaned over and grabbed the book, and he goes, "No, but you should read that, not just look at the pictures." For some reason, this Protestant guy, you know, who later went on to be a police officer in Ireland, is kind of like nudging me and saying, "You know, you should read that." So with a typical criminality, I stole the book for a couple of days, took it home, and actually sat there, you know, in my house, and actually started to, I mean, it took me a minute to even realize, oh, this has text in it. You know, because you're so looking at all these cool pictures, you know, you're like, what, I was 13 years of age or something. So you're just, you know, you're looking at the pictures of the knights and the warriors, and, you know, you're not even aware this thing has text in it. So,
sure, yeah.
You know, here I am. Then I took it back, you know, God knows why. I mean, now I know why, looking back. I mean, this is fate. This is the power of destiny, you know.
Yes.
Because I didn't, I can tell you I didn't learn much else in 18 years of school, but, you know, that doesn't mean that educational things don't happen, like this particular incident. And, for me, I guess this was one of my biggest educations, and it was completely impromptu. It was something that wasn't taught, and it wasn't planned, and it wasn't part of the curriculum, and yet look what it did to my life, this Define This Man's book. That living in Northern Ireland, maybe I never would have come across his book, you know, because again, the subject matters technically. Of course, we know the term politically correct now, and that's what I mean. It would not have been politically correct to, you know, talk about Jim Fitzpatrick or the messages that were in this book, the story of the ancient Irish. And so I read this, and it just turned out that it was 1979. It was just about 9 months or so before I would leave to go to America.
Uh-huh.
You know, with family members, they're dragging us over to America. And my American life was about to begin. So it was at a very crucial moment, a rite of passage almost, because here I am going into the deepest roots of my country, learning about Ireland, but I'm ready to leave. There's your typical, you know, immigration story being replayed again of the Irishman who gets on a boat to go to America, and he's leaving his country as he starts to discover what Ireland really is. I mean, look at the beautiful, you know, it's almost the pathos of that, but at the same time, the tragedy of it, and at the same time, the glory of it, all wrapped up in one, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what that did was, that was the catalyst, because had I not left, well, you know, maybe that book would have just got thrown on the pile. Great book, lovely artwork, fantastic, good story. But by leaving Ireland, at the same time that this stuff was digesting in my mind, it made me more passionate to really get into Irish mythology, because I was leaving the place. It's the famous story of, you know, you get away and you see the mountain from a distance. And I found out, to my utter amazement, that, well, that's what a lot of Americans had been doing as well. That Americans that I would meet in California and elsewhere, and even, you know, from, because at that time I was part of Paul Solomon's Foundation and so on. So we were meeting Americans from all over the country, and they knew more about their own ancestry, especially the Irish descendants, people with Irish ancestry. They knew more about my country than the people I'd grown up with in Ireland, who couldn't care less about the old Irish traditions. So this is how it started. And from then, you know, we picked up one or two other books that became Bibles for me. And of course, there was no glue. There was no knowledge like what I have now. This was just, I'm talking about, you know, utterly being thrown into the middle of it, having no sense of, you know, anything that I know now, just a pure interest, a pure intrigue, a pure sense of fascination and mystery about, my goodness, are you really telling me that ancient people had these kinds of technologies and this kind of wisdom? What happened? Where are we now? You know, it was that kind of a feel. And it was, you know, I was studying the Arthurian legends at the same time and so on. So, but had I not gone to America and found people who were also very knowledgeable about the Celtic tradition, about the goddess tradition, it might never have clicked. And it was back then that I basically started to slowly read the source material, you see, and get very knowledgeable. So by 15 or 16, you know, I mean, you know, I was pretty knowledgeable about various aspects of British and especially Irish mythology, but as a hobby, purely as an interest, no conception of doing anything with it or anything like that. It was just the pure, you know, study, the pure scholastic fascination of, wow, what an interesting subject. Can't get enough of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Why is it important that civilization migrated eastward instead of westward?
Well, we're talking about the elements of civilization, and there's been both ways. It's happened, there has been east to west movements of tribes, of cultural elements. You know, diffusion happens, you can't stop it. But what I'm specifically speaking about is a much, much earlier migration across land bridges that are now sunk beneath the waves.
Uh-huh.
From the west, yeah, from the northwest. And I will not accept, nor can I even really totally understand, why this thesis seems to be so resisted. Well, actually, I know why it's been resisted, but just, you know, for conversation purposes, I think it's actually lunatic to presume that you can go out your gate at the bottom of your street and turn right and walk up the street with no problem, but some mysterious force stops you moving left down the street. This logic defies me, you see. So, in fact, when you take on board the fact that Europe didn't look like it did now, when you take on board the fact that there was probably one or more land bridges connecting Britain to Scandinavia and to the continent, not only do you find that it's a very potentially very possible for the elements of civilization to have moved from the west to the east, you actually find out it would have probably been easier for them to move from the west to the east, because after the land bridges collapse, in historical times, of course, Easterners trying to get to Britain, the job is actually harder because there's no land bridges to walk on. You have to now go by sea. So mere logic tells you that when the land bridges were there, i.e. in prehistorical times, traversal would have been easier the further you go back in time, and harder the further you come up in time.
I see.
So just even these little, you know, points. Not to mention the fact that every other month now we're discovering, you know, more lost cities beneath the ocean. Within the last 2 months, they found off the coast of England. I think it's off the coast of East Anglia, a whole sunken town, and probably a lot more in the mud. You know, and my research has shown that this is the case all the way up to Scotland and round and so forth, that there definitely was these connecting land bridges. So the east to west migrations that took place of peoples took place, but it took place in periods of historical times, meaning from about 600 BC through to 600 AD. There was waves of migration. And those waves of migration, one of them I'm thinking of, was caused by enormous eruption of Santorini, the volcano of Santorini, the famous Thera. People can read about it in the volume 2.
Yeah.
The volcano on Santorini in the Mediterranean caused untold devastation, you see, which sent a lot of Mediterranean and Eastern Asian people moving towards the west. You had a famine during the time of Akhenaten. In fact, it killed four of his daughters, and it eradicated most of Egypt. So you've had famines that moved people westward. You had a thing called the Mycenaean drought, which was one of the worst droughts in recorded history that happened. Again, I think it was a BC. I can't remember the date, but it's in the book. This drought was of such magnitude that it totally destroyed the economy and the all the infrastructure, both economic and farming, and whatever you want, you know, all it totally decimated the nations of the east, sending many, many people migrating into the west. And so all the ancient mythographers who talked about migrations from the east to the west mentioned the migrations, but never really why those migrations would have taken place. In recent times, through the work of several geologists and through other archaeologists, you see, who've been digging up not only the fact that there were migrations from the east to the west, but the reasons why. But you see, the fact is that all these migrations were prompted by ecological disasters or cataclysms. Well, 10,000 years before these ones I've just mentioned, there was unbelievable cataclysms which very much hurt the lands of the northwest even worse than these later devastations. And it caused the exact same problem. In other words, people were forced to leave their homes. They didn't want to. So the ancient indigenous people of Scotland, Ireland, you see, England, the British Isles, also of Scandinavian countries, were absolutely forced to move in an eastern and southerly direction. But this happened before recorded time. And there's a big reason why the normal historians and so-called experts and investigators will never, ever admit this and will not talk about it, even though if you do your own homework by yourself, like I have, you'll find endless evidence for it, endless connections between the Irish people, you see, and Egypt, which is one of the most fascinating aspects that I go into in the book. But it's not just with them. There's a tremendous connection with the Scythians, a group of people that frequented northern Turkey and the steppes of Russia called the Scythians, who turn out to be Irish by extraction. There's questions about Armenia. Armenian culture is one of the oldest cultures, and many of the drawings and the artwork and jewelry making and even their language bears striking resemblances to the ancient Irish, you see, the Greek, and I'm talking about Proto-Greek because you can't trust modern Greek scholarship. What we've been told about the Greeks as we know it is mostly utter rubbish. I'm talking about the Proto-Greeks, that would be the Etruscans, you see, and the people called the Dorians, and a very interesting group called the Pelasgians. I am absolutely convinced that these people were Irish by extraction. They were part of the group that had migrated from the west and had settled where we now know Greeks. So I believe that the Proto-Greeks were actually Nordic people. They were actually Gothic, Nordic, Indo-Europeans who had come out of the west. And we know this because the earliest ancestors of the Greeks, who are these Pelasgians, when the archaeologists go to the Pelasgian settlement that they're excavating, they find stone circles not similar to Irish, but identical to Irish. So that clinches it. You know, there's the facts. There's the facts. Another interesting phenomenon that proves this is the use of the megalithic yard and the megalithic mile. This is a measurement that geomancers and architects, anyone that deals with measurements, earth measurements, civic engineering, building, construction, they know that today, you know, we've used the foot and we use the meter. Yeah, but we didn't, you know, isn't it obvious to any listener that it wasn't the foot and it wasn't the meter that was being used in ancient times? Well, the ancient measurement that was used by the ancient people when they were building all these stone circles, when they're laying out their villages, when they were laying out their temples and their shrines, and when they were orienting the different ley lines, was a thing called the megalithic yard, which is part of the megalithic mile. And it's not too far distant from the Egyptian cubit. Well, they've actually found now that this cubit and this megalithic yard moved from the west to the east. That this measurement turns up in younger monuments that are in the east, but in older monuments and layouts in the west, meaning that whoever used this measurement came from the west. And the two people have written about this who've discovered it is a guy called Alan Butler and Stephen Defoe, and you can read all about it on my appendices section. If people go to the Irish Origins of Civilization, click through to the appendices section and go to the link on the Minoan civilization. This is the Minoans of Crete. I have excerpted their book, but people who really want to study should pick up their book called The Knights Templar Revealed and read about the salt lines, read about the megalithic yard, and how these people who themselves don't espouse what I am espousing, but I'm talking about a reference work here that people who are familiar with my work will easily see in Alan and, Defoe's book, you see, in Butler and Defoe's work, they'll see my thesis. It's not that they are talking about my thesis, but if you read their book, you'll see that my work is confirmed by what they're saying. So this is how you refer to the work of other people, and look at it and see the concluding evidence that they can't understand how this occurred, because again, they're still buying into the idea of, you know, Eastern groups moving west only in more historical times. They still haven't, you know, wakened up to this idea that, hey, hang on a minute, do you not realize that super civilized elders, with all of their symbols, with all of their music, with all of their basket weaving, with all of their mathematical ingenuity and understanding and wealth of knowledge, their cosmology, their cosmogony, their mythology, their religious traditions, you see, and many other little lesser important things, these all migrated into the East. And that is how, in China, you can be digging up Caucasian mummies, both of male and female, that are dressed from head to foot in tartan that you can only find in Britain, and with their hair braided like only the women ever used to do in Denmark. Things like this. Nowhere else in the world is the hair braided in that way. First of all, they're golden-haired people. They have fair complexions, and they have blonde hair and golden hair. I mean, that alone should startle you, and has startled these people. So you have the Tocharians, you have the Pajaric people, you see. You have the in America, you have the Pahona, the Hopi Indians talking about the Pahonas, and the whole concept of the white gods, you see, who came and visited. So if the Native American Indians of the American continent can be convinced that they were visited from their east, meaning our Europe, by the white brothers, the Pahona, tell me why it's so preposterous for an Eastern European or an Asian person to accept the fact that they were visited, you see, by their Westerners. And in fact, they don't deny it, because anytime you go to the East, they're always happy to tell you that the word Syria and the word Iran and even India, you see, and the Indus Valley was colonized by Westerners. They have no problem. It's all in the mythology. The only group who refutes this are the ones with the most to lose should the ordinary man work out the truth about the way the planet looked, the way the countries were divided and separated, and the kind of migrations that took place, and the kind of homogeneity of these groups. They have been trying to deceive us about this, telling us lie after lie about the country of Egypt, making it look like a great civilization, yes, but that it was autonomous and just developed its own culture without any major connections to everywhere else. A complete and utter lie. Because how can cocaine be discovered, you see, in the tombs of the mummies? How can coca leaves be found there? How can elephants pictures of elephants be discovered in South America? How can Negroid, you know, Olmec people appear to be frequenters of Brazil and the South America? You see, we have so many questions. We have so many alternative historians like Michael Cremo, who wrote Forbidden Archaeology, or Glenn Kimball, who's absolutely shown that the great mounds of North America contain Celtic artifacts. You know, the list goes on. We found all sorts of mummies and buried evidence. But until you put all the pieces together, it's difficult to account for all of this, you see, until we have a massive, well, it's the famous worldview. The worldview, the zeitgeist, has to change. And it is changing. It's absolute, we are now absolutely ready, like I said in my first book, for the truth about the world. And the first thing you have to understand about Europe is it wasn't divided into France and Spain and Belgium and Netherlands and, you know, and if you go further east, there was no Iran and Kuwait and all of this nonsense. This is another form of sort of mind control where these hypothetical demarcations created by governments after the First and Second World War are presented to every school kid. So you imagine that was, you know, that's it. That's the way that Europe has always looked. Nothing could be further from the truth. And then the historians have told you, well, here's where these Celtic tribes were. And these are mostly Roman historians who'd love to break up the world in a political way just like that. But their little schemata of the world is no more logical or accurate than our modern schemata of Europe, the way we've divided the countries and so on and so forth. You've got to go beyond that. You've got to use your logic and think, okay, who were ancient men? Where would they have wanted to settle? What gods and goddesses did they worship? So what kind of land would have been sacred to them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to completely, you know, get rid of this programming about the way Europe looked and about the way the tribes might have settled and the way their culture and what they thought was of great importance. And so in my work, I really take exception with this question of race. And that one of the things that really has to go is that race mattered to the ancient people, you know, but that's a whole other subject, but people can read about it in the book. That again, we've been given a total tissue, a web of lies about the belief systems of ancient people.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also about one of the most fascinating and important things that you talk about in this new book is how the word Aryan became corrupted and messed with. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely, because that goes straight to the heart of this question.
Sure.
Because nothing portrays for us the level of deception until you get into something like this. This particular, you know, thesis about the word Aryan is a perfect case study for what was actually the reality and then what became the misreality. It's a perfect acid test of that. Basically, the word Aryan actually means Irish. The word Irish or Ireland is in fact a corruption of the word Arya. And if you take it back to its earliest permutation, what it really meant is it meant nothing but the earth. In fact, it actually represented the goddess of the earth, who was known as Ari or Eri. So either with an I or with an A, it was interchangeable. We actually still use the word today in the word terra, which we think is a Latin word meaning the earth, terra.
Uh-huh.
Like terra firma, you see, or
yep.
Terrestrial. Yeah.
Yep.
So if you take off the T, you have Eri or Era. That's the goddess name of Ireland. She was one of the earliest goddesses of Ireland, and her name was Eri. The Greeks picked up on her with Hera. They put an H on the beginning, but H was a letter that meant the, just like the L does in French. So if somebody in French language says the letter L or the letter L-E or the letter L-A or L-E-S, people who know French will know that that is a word you put on the beginning of words to say the something or other.
Right, right.
Well, that is what the word the letter H also was used as. So Hera, if the H is silent, is just Era. The Greeks are referring to the goddess of the earth. That was her original homeland was Ireland. So Eri or Arya just meant the man of Ireland, but it meant more than that. Its first connotation was it meant the wise ones. It meant those who are initiates of the great mysteries of life. They're the astrologer class, they're the elders, they're the healers of the earth, they're the servants of truth. And they were not located only in Ireland. So this is what people who pick up my book and go, what's this guy talking about, Irish origins or whatever, total nonsense. first of all, they haven't even bothered to find out what I mean when I mean the word Ireland, or, excuse me, when I use the word Irish. I'm talking about a worldwide Aryan organization, the Ari, or the Aria, not located only in Ireland, that was their headquarters, but this was a worldwide organization in exactly the same way that later Christian monks colonized the entire planet, what we would call the missionaries and so on. So the Irish origins of civilization is a story not about Ireland specifically, but about the Aria, those elders that we have just blithely forgotten about, and it's easy to do since they were mostly all slaughtered. I'm bringing back the story of who these people were, and these people are nothing different than the Ammonists of Egypt. And the only distinction I'd make is that in an Egyptian context is we do have to distinguish them from another group in Egypt called the Athenists, because the Aria and the Druids is not the same as the Athenists, but they are identical in my opinion. And this point, of course, can be argued to, you know, infinitum. But I have no difficulty in my mind at all, given the symbolism, given the kind, the style of worship, given the respect for women, given the fact that they also embodied the moon as well as the sun, and they had a much more balanced pantheon. All of these elements, also let's not forget about the fact that given the fact that they dug these Caucasian guys up in Egypt, I mean, hello, we're falling into their graves, so I mean, let's not beat around the bush here. And given that even megalithic sites have been discovered in the Sudan and Nubia, I have no problem understanding that the people that Egyptians refer to as the Ammonists, and the Ammonists are referring to their own ancestors as the Shamsu Hor, meaning the disciples of Horus. And given that the fact that Horus is described as the blue-eyed god, etc., I have no problem accepting that the Ammonists and the Druids, or the Ammonists and the Aria, are one and the same group. So, and this goes for most of the lands of the world at that time, that these Aria were known in Sumeria. I believe that there's strong connections between the Druid Aria to the group called the Amorites. I think that they also had connections to the Scythians. In fact, my work goes a long way to try and elucidate for people who was the famous Hyksos people of Egypt. This has been a bone of contention for many generations now.
Yeah.
So it's a tremendous question. It's a tremendous question of who the Hyksos were, and nobody has really had a consensus. The person that I respect the most, I think has come closest, is the famous author Ralph Ellis, who has done great work on the Hyksos, and he shows, importantly, the connection of the Hyksos dynasty of Egypt with Akhenaten, of course. He's brought that out beautifully. He's definitely spent a few paragraphs talking about that they may be loosely, he thinks that they're connected in some way to the Cretans, and I believe that. I think there's probably a strong connection to the Minoans, the Hyksos and the Cretans. At the very least, they had business connections with one another. They at least had mercantile connections if they weren't connected by blood. Other scholars have thought the Hyksos is related to the Philistines. I mean, you know, there's it's endless. But the strongest connections, and I don't know why other scholars have not brought this out, is again to the Scythians. The Scythians had settlements, just like the Phoenicians did, in Egypt. In fact, there's an excavated site in Galilee, believe it or not, which is to this day called Scythopolis. So anybody that would doubt that the Scythians, these horseback riders, you know, from the steppes of Russia and northern Turkey, could find their way, you know, down through the Mediterranean and down through Asia Minor into Egypt, well, you better believe they did, because even the term, even they had one of their main headquarters, which used to be in ancient times called Beit Shan, is called Scythopolis, the city of the Scythians. And there's reason to believe that the Scythians even had other bastions of power right in the Delta area, right into Egypt, just in exactly the same way that the Phoenicians had done. So in my work, there's a strong connection between the Hyksos dynasty and the Scythians. But the most interesting part of that, of this story, is that the Scythians themselves' ancestry goes back to Ireland, because the earliest chronicles of Ireland talk about the Scythians being of Irish extraction. So even if you look into only that, you've got a fascinating connection. And that's not invented by me. That's an established historical connection between established groups that have connections to Ireland and also to Egypt, right in the normal lexicon, right in the normal canon. And yet, for some reason, this connection has been downplayed or overlooked. And see, a scholar like me, a researcher like me, wants to know why that is, because to me it's quite blatant. Is there a reason then why somebody has purposely not explored that Scythian-Hyksos connection? Because that would open the entire ball of wax of the Western movement. that would open the whole ball of wax into the Druid connection to Egypt, the most taboo subject that you can think of on this planet? Is that the reason why even a very obvious, and I would say quite, you know, fascinating, and certainly you'd want to explore that, then how come practically no scholar, not even Ralph Ellis, as great as he is, has even wanted to investigate that avenue? Well, see, that's a red flag for me. That's like saying, well, of course they won't want to explore it, because the world has gone bent over backwards. The historians of the world have bent over backwards. They spent billions of dollars trying to make sure that you never see a connection between Britain and Egypt. They'll die before they'll accept that. And any symbol that turns up in Europe or Britain or Denmark or Norway or Sweden or any other country that looks like, you know, it might have some mysterious occult properties, they're going to tell you it was Jews that brought it east. It's Judean. Utter nonsense.
Yeah.
The red, the famous coronation stone, or the harp, you know, which they say is the harp of David, without even knowing what David is, or the red hand of Ulster, the three crowns, the lion, the dragon that you see on the Welsh and Scottish flags, etc., etc., etc. I have an entire chapter on the symbolism. I've got 550 pictures in the book, so we go into all of this. And these are not Judaic symbols. At least as long as you discover what the word Judaic means. These are symbols that arrived in the East thousands of years before they were brought back into the West. And the simple matter is that when the great land masses of Northeast were utterly torn to pieces in a way that people who in Indonesia with the tsunami there, that's like a bird bath compared to what, you know, wrecked the lands of the North and separated the lands of the North and destroyed the old Atlantean, what we now call Atlantis. When that havoc and that destruction forced the people out of their habitats to migrate south and east, they brought with them all of these symbols. But then, like anybody, their descendants will return 1,000, 5,000, whatever years later, not the originals, but the descendants, when a semblance of normality has returned, exactly the way you would do if your town was wrecked by some type of catastrophe, and then you are forced to move away to live as a refugee. Chances are you'd return once the houses have been rebuilt, you see, and normalcy returns to your neighborhood. You're going to want to return. If not just to bury, if not to honor your dead, there's 101 reasons why you'd return, and especially if you were these ancient people who worshipped the land as a goddess and felt honor bound to go back to heal her. We're not talking about the delinquents that we are today of historical times who couldn't care less. We're talking about people who were eager to get back because they were returning to their goddess, and it was their job to pick up the stones and pick up the rocks and pile them together in these big monuments that I can take you to and put your nose in. And people can't explain this to this day, these tiny little stones and these tiny little rocks piled up in a massive mounds, like Queen Maeve's tomb up in Northern Ireland, and so many other examples I can give you, Crevy Creel and all the ones that I mentioned in the book. And these are all over, to be found all over Brittany and all over Scandinavia. That's right. Let's ask a question. Who would amass in hundreds of people to pick up tiny little stones and go and put them in a mound? Visualized in your mind, who would do that? It's very simple. It's people who gave a damn about the earth and who looked at the earth as a living entity who had been destroyed, and now a ritual had to be performed, not only to galvanize the people who themselves had suffered enormous trauma. The Druids were very smart psychologically. They knew, hey, if we get people to pick up these rocks and these stones, it's also good to galvanize us again. And the very symbol of the stone, as the Shiva worshippers in India understand, the very symbol of a rock, you know, Petra, the whole idea of the Herm establishment, standing up, rectifying, raising the pillar. The Masons even use this concept of the raising of the pillar to represent order and structure has returned. So the building of the pyramid and the erection of the obelisks in Egypt, and the fact of their size and the fact of their stability and the fact of even their shape, that the largest part would be on the ground and the shrunken part would be at the top, just like a pyramid is, that represents something to the psychology of ancient people, that we are now back to terra firma. We are now established again. And the entrance portals, like even the Tower of Babel, you see, they talk about the entrance to the Tower of Babel being quite high up, as it is in the pyramid, as it is in the round towers of Ireland, you see. This idea of putting the entrance high up is to say that should another cataclysm come involving water, all the sacred relics of our culture, all of the sacred treasures can be put inside these water-resistant buildings. You see? So the ancients were thinking a lot about not only restoring order and building a gigantic symbol of order and stability again and restitution again, that the gods are again pleased with us, so that the whole people who've been traumatized can see it and look at it and feel like it's a mandala of order. But they were also preparing that should another one happen, we'll have these coffers inside, and we'll have these secret rooms where the relics and the papers and whatever can be placed. And we know that this is very important, because look what happened at the Twin Towers when Building 7 go down. Wasn't it Building 7 that had all the FBI documents and CIA documents?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's the same thing. A building contains the archives, and if that building should by any chance be destroyed, well, there, that's it. That's it. There's no recovery of those buildings. There's no recovery of that information, I should say. So the ancients were working pretty much on the same level. They were working partly practically, but they were working psychologically. And this accounts for the mass of ancient sites. Not all were built after the cataclysm. Some were built before, but there's a mix-match. And many of them were built afterwards because these represented sites of stability, so that whenever the group or the tribe would not come for a meeting, especially after they had returned home and things hadn't become totally established, the stone circle or the megalith or the dolmen or the cairn or the rath, all of these ancient sites, you see, the tumuli, like Silbury Hill and Glastonbury Tor, these places would become the center where all the people would gather. And they always talk about this. In the most ancient legends of Ireland, you always hear about the priestesses gathering the people at the mountain. It just meant the hill or the mound, the great mountain. Patrick coming down from the mountain. You know, Jesus Christ, his Sermon on the Mount. Well, that's a Druidic device right there, by the way. People read the Bible and wouldn't even spot the Druidic symbolism in it. The fig tree, the Mount of Olives, the Garden of Gethsemane, Golgotha, the Skull Hill. They don't know where all this comes from. They don't know that half the references in the Bible are actually to places like Edinburgh. And if you told them that, they'd think you're a raving lunatic. I mean, yeah, it's been proven, but do you think they care about the proof? No, they believe what the Bible tells them. They're not really to investigate it.
Yeah.
They're going to believe what the Caesar, and I'm not just talking about the Caesar in Rome, I'm talking about King James, Caesar of England. He taps Bacon on the head and says, you write what I tell you. Bacon writes it, everyone believes it. They chained the Bibles to the altars for hundreds of years, so you couldn't even read it anyway. And people haven't done much better homework since, if you really want my honest opinion about it. They still, to this day, even with their Jesus seminars and all of the money they expend, they still can't tell you who the Essenes were. They still haven't wrapped it around who are these white robe wearing. They have found out that they probably weren't even Jewish. They were probably Gentile. They can't work out that the Essenes was an offshoot of the Druidic order. They were a later shadow, just like the Bogomils and the Cathars and the Albigensians. And that's exactly why the Latin Church wanted to destroy them all. It wasn't just because they were Gnostics. It was much more than that. These were people who were trying to go back to the old religion of... Because where are the Cathars? Where are the Albigensians? Where were the Bogomils? They're all in France, in exactly the same locations as the ancient Druids had their temples in prehistoric times. So these were Christian groups who wanted to hold on to their Christianity, but at the same time blend their Christianity with some of the older pagan ways of the Druids. Well, that was taboo to the Christian church, so that's why they were slaughtered. So we have Druidism, a worldwide organization here. And the cataclysms that took place, the migrations from the east to the west, I believe were returns. Capital R, capital E, capital T. Return. They were not, as historians have told us, the first migrations. That here you have a naked England and a naked Ireland with a bunch of, even if there's people there, they're a bunch of bone-chucking, skin-wearing, freezing, primitives. And suddenly, the wise ones of Moses and the wise ones of Jeremiah and the wise ones of, Christ, Joseph of Arimathea, they come with their staff and their robes, standing on the prow of the great British Israelite boat, to bring civilization to the Irish. And hasn't the English treated the Irish in exactly that way from time immemorial? Isn't that the kind of bogus crap they talk about when they came here to civilize the Native American Indians?
Civilize
the Maya and civilize the Aztecs and civilize the Aboriginals? I mean, come on, you're colonized if you believe this stuff. You're colonialized in your mind, It's the biggest tosh you've ever read about. Thousands of years before these Caesars even took birth, the Phoenicians had navigated the oceans of the world. and mapped the heavens and the stars, for God's sake, who invented language, invented the alphabet. And no amount of scheming from these Smithsonian and Royal Academy, you know, tossers is going to change that fact, because you'll, for every one of those liars, you'll always have a Professor Thompson. For every one of those liars, you're always going to have a Ralph Ellis. You're always going to have a Barry Fell. You're always going to have a Augustus Laplanjean, you see?
Yeah.
And you're always going to have these other scholars, the Commons Beaumonts of the world, who will stand up and refute their lies.
Fascinating. Very fascinating.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And the word Arya meant nothing more than pure one. Along come the Nazis, along come the... And by the way, the Nazis is nothing more than an extension of the British fascism that started in Britain. They may have been black swastika-wearing Germans by birth, but ideologically and religiously and whatever you want to call it, they got British pounds in their pocket. Their bank accounts are from Britain through Switzerland, through the Masonic orders of Belgium, Switzerland, and Britain. There's nothing German about any Nazi. And in fact, I'm horrified when I hear people refer to Germany, to a German, as if the word Nazi is, you know, indistinguishable. It's an absolute obscenity to believe that, because the Nazis were no more German for Germany than George Bush is America for America, not for American for America now.
Well, it's funny you mentioned George Bush, because his grandfather, Prescott, was one of the primary financiers of Adolf Hitler.
Absolutely.
And when I found that out, I was like, whoa, that puts
right.
a whole different spin on things, doesn't it?
Sure it does. Yeah, we've had whistleblowers admit this. We've had insiders find out about it. We've had outsiders find out about it.
Yeah.
People need to look up in a future DVD I'm doing in the Architects of Control series. We'll be talking about von Thyssen, and we'll be talking about Helmut Schlacht, and we'll be talking about Prescott Bush, and we'll be talking about these connections. This is a worldwide fascist organization. It has ancient roots, and it's ensconced in America, presenting itself behind the Stars and Stripes as if it's American, just like it presented itself in Germany behind the swastika as if it is German. People need to wake up, and behind behind these symbols lies one international secret order that has no national allegiance whatsoever. That's just rhetoric. That's just sophism that you hear. It's what Colonel Bo Greitz called bushlip. And it's not to be believed by the people. They've got to realize that they're being preyed upon by these individuals. And so when the Nazis came along, and their ideologists, and I mentioned who all these people were in book one, I believe, of the Irish origins, I show their pictures and describe so the people can work it out that when they took this word Aryan and went to town with it, that these are British agents skewing the word so that the history of that word would be permanently contaminated. And the fact of the matter is that it simply referred to anyone of any culture, of any race, or of any tribe, or anywhere in the world who happened to be a man of the stars, a man of truth, a worshipper of the goddess, a healer of the earth, or anyone who had worked on themselves, anyone who was an initiate of the mystery schools, was an Arya, pure and simple. It did not refer to race, because race simply didn't enter into it with the ancient people of the world. If a group of Irishmen encountered a bunch of tribesmen in the hills of the Pamir Mountains of Pakistan, what was of interest to the migrant was not whether these tribesmen were of a different race than you, it's of what gods did you worship. And when it was found that they worshiped the same stars in the heavens, they had the same mythology, they worshiped the same gods like the stag, you know, or the eagle, you were kindred. You were literally, you understood that you were kindred. And this is why ancient groups were able to assimilate very easily. And that's why Eastern groups always accepted these Western travelers, these golden men, or the men of the hawk, or the eagle men, or the Edomites, the red men. Because you can better believe that when a white Caucasian from Ireland or Norway heads out to equatorial lands, he's going to be burning so red. And his hair is dyed blonde with lime. Not only did they have the blonde hair naturally, but even some of the darker guys would dye their hair, you know, with limestone, this lime stuff. It was a habit of the women and the ancient Nordics to actually even put lime in their hair to dye it almost completely white. This was a habit. Now, if you have long, cascading blonde hair, piercing blue eyes, and burning red skin, and you climb off a horse in the middle of Pakistan, or off a boat down in Sidon in Asia Minor, right? I would imagine that people would pay attention to the way you look. And if you're covered in copper jewelry, the ancient Goths also wore copper jewelry, which is red, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
They say Ireland is green. Do you know why Ireland is so green? It's from the verdigris. It's the byproduct mineral ore of the copper in the land, by the way.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so copper in ancient times was one of the biggest imports, along with gold and silver, from Ireland. And the men of Ireland and the men who dug the copper were known as the Red Men, because they not only were burning red, the poor buggers were sweating like pigs and burned red in the sun, just like today it happens, very painful, tall, you see, piercing blue eyes, etc., wearing from head to foot, them and their women were covered in this bright, shining copper trinkets and so forth. So they were called the Red Men. Simple as that. The Phoenicians were also called the Red because they dyed their capes in purple, and they brought these red capes and the coats of many colors, which you hear about Joseph, the coat of many colors. That's not only a reference to the solar cult, where the head druid would literally wear a robe of ancient of colors. I have the quotes in the book. But it also refers to the Phoenician horde, who were nothing but men from the west who were the mariners who came to the east. And the earliest cities in the east, in fact, are built by these people, places like Sidon. The very word Bible, by the way, comes from an ancient city called Byblos that is a Phoenician city. And the deity, the head deity, the head god, whose temple was in Byblos, that was worshipped, meaning the tutelary god of the city, was called Adon, that later the Greeks changed to Adonis. But Adon is the Adonai of the so-called biblical Old Testament Jews, who are not the Jews that people think today. Again, another brainwashing, conditioning image has been handed to you about what a Jew is. Jews believe it falsely, and Christians believe it falsely. But what they don't look into is the fact that the God of these so-called Israelites of the Old Testament was Adonai, is nothing more than the Phoenician Adon, or the Greek Adonis, the beautiful God of the sun, that later is rescripted as Jehovah, which is a cover story in order to hide the fact that I'm talking to you right now about. They didn't want this fact to be known, so they tweaked his name and slapped on the name Jehovah, which was an old, ancient, ominous name from one of the old gods, lunar gods of Egypt, that was also worshipped in other outlying areas of Egypt. And his name is Ahu, or Yahu, or basically Yahweh, Yahu, Yahweh, after the yew tree of the Celts, and after the moon goddess, a moon god. So they composed a bunch of different gods together to cover up the fact that of this Irish, Scythian, Phoenician connection, you see, to the great mystery schools of Byblos and Sidon and other Phoenician cities that covered the East, like Alexandria and many others. So the amount of deception, and we're living in it. We're living in that sea of deception, but we're also living in an era in which we can start to calm the waters down and see through all of this web of lies, you see, this whole miasma, and start to see the clear refraction now of what's really going on. We have that amount of freedom. We have that amount of intellectual curiosity. We have the facts at our disposal. We have the internet. We have radio shows like you. We have this knowledge, and it's coming out again. And it's for people to really start understanding what has really been going on here with this this control mechanism that's existed in the world of brainwashing and utter cannibalization of ancient traditions. So when you're looking at masonry, so people say, how does this all fit in with today, or what's this got to do with the New World Order, Michael, or what's this got to do with secrets? Well, wait a minute. Every single thing that is in the design of Washington, and the design of Paris, and the design of Cologne, and the design of Philadelphia, every single thing you see on the dollar bill, everything you see in the state government buildings, everything you see them in the corporations of the world, everything you see in the United States of Europe that's coming upon us, everything that's in masonry, Templarism, Rosicrucianism, What do you think that is, if not a cannibalism of all of this Amonist, Atonist stuff that I've been talking about? It has everything to do with it. There's not a thing that these characters do in the presidency without it being based on astrotheology. I just put a link up that was on Red Ice, of the Clint. It was Richard Hoagland wrote it, and it was about the entire one of the Clinton's addresses when the star Sirius was rising in the sky, and the heart of the lion Regulus was 33 degrees of celestial orientation in the sky at the very moment that Bill Clinton utters the first words of a most weird and mysterious address, in which he's talking about weird secrets and all sorts of weird, genetic future. Uh-huh. We posted it on the symbolism page, on the top, the hot links. People go to the forum and go into the symbolism section of my forum. It's one of the top links there. Go in there and see it. Provable, scientifically prove it.
Oh, but that's just the coincidence.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
My friend Andrew Power, he proved that the Battle of the Boyne was based on an absolute astrotheological or mathematics and computations, that exactly as certain planets were crossing the Milky Way, as soon as certain conjunctions were taking place, this is when the commencement of one of the most important events in Irish history turns out to be an occult event, because he and I have helped to expose the occult histories of Ireland. People have to realize there's an occult history of their countries, and it's going on right now. People are being brainwashed by it right now. It's absolutely a form of sorcery that's in our midst at this very moment in time, but its roots are very, very ancient. And so it's important to address the sorcery that's happening, but it's also very important to address where it came from. This is how you look at something. You look at the beginning, middle, and end of it. If you want to see the whole canvas, you don't just go over and put a telescope, microscope up and look at one area. The person stands back and looks at the entire framing of this thing. That's what my work is about. Because there's lots of great scholars, and we're all working on, hey, what's happening now, and what's going to come down the road. But it's equally important when you're standing on the peak of a mountain to look at where you've come from, and where did this Leviathan begin? Where's the, where the head is? Where's the tail?
Sure. Yeah. How and why were the druids exterminated? What was the reason for that?
Oh, it's very, very important, and it happened in several different waves of different levels of intensity.
Uh-huh.
And we'll start in reverse, because we'll start with what people will recognize. And I'll work my way back to the areas that they're not told about.
Okay.
The first persecutions that people will know about are the most recent ones, which happened with when the Romans got to England and Ireland. And I believe it was Augustus and Claudius, or it was Augustus and it was Caligula, that first made excursions, militaristic excursions into Britain about AD 43, AD 34, something like that, in order to quell elements of rebellion. And again, I'm talking more about official history here. Then, of course, it was the all-out attack, or basically act of colonialism, AD 55 with Julius Caesar, when the waves of Romans, we see, were sent in to basically overtake the entire place and to deal with it. So this is accurate. In the history books, this, I would say, would be a pretty accurate description of the twilight of the Druids. By this time, they were eradicated. When the Roman army, the very famous story, I have it in the book, were a very, very famous story of them coming to the Isle of Anglesey and literally slaughtering all the women and all the men, and all the top Druids by that time had, gone to Wales to hide on the island of Anglesey, and they were slaughtered. So that is the basic swan song there. But that wasn't the only attack. That's the attack that history speaks about and has ratified. As a matter of fact, I believe that the process of the elimination of the Druids actually took place possibly up to 300 and maybe even up to 500 years before that. It was a process. And to understand how the first waves of attack on the Druids began to happen around about 500 BC, we're back in Egypt again. Here is yet another, not another, but one of the most fascinating connections between the lands of Ireland and Egypt is at this period of time. Even more interesting than the connections between the Scythian, quote-unquote, Celts and the Egyptians that I spoke of earlier, this one to me is the most fascinating, because I believe that it was the Atenists of Egypt, a group called the Atenists of Egypt, whose head chief was Akhenaten, no less, the Pharaoh Akhenaten. He didn't get to Ireland, he had died. But within a few centuries of his death, his descendants, and some people even, the ancient chronicles even hint that his own daughter, who was known as Meretaten, meaning beloved of Aton, for people who don't understand this, it's Aton was a god that they worshipped, the sun god, god of light, who is very much worshipped today under other names. These Atenists, the people I refer to as Atenists, had no love for the Druids, and the reason why they had no love for the Druids is they had no love in Egypt for the Ammonists, because in order to understand, to have a thumbnail guide to Egyptian history, very hard to do in a couple of sentences, but people can grasp this one fact, that the largest solar cults in Egypt were the Ammonists, as I said before, and it's spelled exactly as they say, people say Amen at the end of a prayer, Amen. And it was the worship of the god Amen-Ra. But the Ammonists had rivals, and the rivals was this very, very specific and highly unusual group called the Atenists, who were followers of the Pharaoh Akhenaten, who was basically the destroyer of Egypt. He was an extremely warped, megalomaniac, and sinister character. And in my researches, I believe it's his descendants that, after they were thrown out of Egypt, made their way to many other countries where they had many, many allies. As I said, they were allies of the Scythians, and the Scythians were to welcome them. They had allies amongst the Minoans, the Cretans of Crete, because that little tiny island that people think, oh yeah, Crete, that little island in the Mediterranean, my goodness, if people would only study the Cretan mythology, they'd be highly educated, because it's a fascinating place. They had allies amongst the Greeks, and Ralph Ellis even suspects that the word Athens itself might even be named after Aten or Aton. Officially, Athens is named after Athena, but you know that could be not true. It actually could be named after the Egyptian god Aton. So, and they also had friends in Italy and Rome, and they also made their way with the Scythians. The Scythians, as I said, had originally come from Ireland. So after a couple of hundred years, these Egyptian exiles made their way to Spain, and then I believe arrive in Irish mythology as a group called the Milesians. So if this is hard to follow for people, they need to read the book. But it's a very interesting set of connections. And the Atenists, when they got to Ireland, were known as the Milesians because their king was called Mile, in exactly the way we spell the word mile today, M-I-L-E. And I believe in my work that the Milesians were these crypto Egyptians, Atenists. And getting to Ireland, they had to then open discourse with the Druidic chieftains of Ireland. And what does Irish history say about this? Is that immediately the Druids put to death the first king that came, the first representative, the first prince or whatever of the Atenists who came from Spain to open negotiations, was immediately put to death because the Druids knew who it was, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And this then starts to become very, very, very confirmative that, wait a minute here, and you can read it in the ancient legends. They say that the three kings of they were up at Londonderry at the time, Derry coming from the word Dwara, meaning Druid. So the three kings of Derry were dead suspicious, and they talked amongst themselves, it's right in the legends, and they say, we got to do away with this guy because we know what he's after. He's coming here to conquer. So they killed this guy, and they buried him. And still people can go to the plain, the field in which is called Ith's Plain to this day. It's in the legends. But of course, Ith's colleagues went back to Spain saying to King Mile that, hey, he's been, the prince is dead. And so the Atenists invaded. As Wilhelm Reich would say, the artificialization of your mind and your relationship to your body. Then we can get into what Marshall McLuhan said, and before him, the great French philosopher Jean Baudrillard, who spoke about a thing called a simulacra. In short, what they said is that mankind, the technological man, the post-industrial man, is making a world so plastic, so artificial, that everything around him is plastic and artificial, that he, without even intentionalizing it, becomes an artificial element within his own creation. He literally becomes a plastic creature, a totally artificial creature, because his environment is entirely artificial, because environment is everything in psychology and sociology. So if you've then made a world that is utterly full of fake relationships, where relationships and connections between people have reduced to the most pornographic, lowest level, immoral, treacherous, hypocritical level, and everything around you that's inanimate is purely manufactured, and that your neighborhoods are entirely manufactured or based on the grid system or whatever, you know, getting into the sacred geometry of it. In other words, your whole society, streets, is all artificialized. How can you then remain human within that artificial environment? It's ludicrous. You, the rat, in your own maze, will become as artificial, and that's called a simulacra. And you know something? I see the work of Jean Baudrillard as absolutely coming to pass in our world today. And it's like that movie Tron, in which they're actually inside the computer game. You wonder if the person is a human or it's a holographic projection. And believe me, the technology is on its way. An avalanche of new man technology, of post-human technology, is on its way. Because this is the perfect escape for the man who has absolutely crucified himself, immolated his own emotions. He can no longer deal with his emotions. He can no longer deal with the darker emotions specifically. Mm. And so now a new virtual empire is presented to him, in which he can choose multiple kinds of self. Just like in the British sci-fi comedy, they show Red Dwarf, in which they have a cyber game, in which when you plug into it, you can basically choose multiple different kinds of personalities. You can be the gunfighter, you know, you can be a knight, you can be a lover, a great lover, you know, any kind of a persona that you can adopt and live out all sorts of interesting, fascinating scenarios in a virtual mindscape. I'm telling you that not only are people will never have to be cajoled into accepting that, people are going to be lining up for it. It'll be by demand. It'll be the biggest thing, and it will be the extinction, annihilation of the human. And this stuff is targeted for about 2012. If we don't see it already by 2012, 2012 will be the initial beginning of a new era, which I refer to as this post-human, you know, cybernetic age. And it's been written, we're not making anything up here. This has been written down. This is in the manifestos of the very people that my work and the future DVDs we're going to really get into exposing and show who these philosopher people are, who are these thinkers that have concocted all of this mechanistic philosophy. And the people that you see on TV and in the public eye are merely lieutenants. These are people who are merely exons, pages. They're people who are carrying out the orders. And people in America should know a little bit about this, because they've probably heard the word Leo Strauss. That if you're talking about neocons, well, then you can't think about what you can call neoconservatism without thinking of certain people like Leo Strauss, meaning shadowy, hidden philosopher types, you see, that you'll never hear about taught in school. Or the Colonel Mandel Houses, you see, or the, you know, the Rothschilds, or the Oppenheimers, or even the Wallensteins, and so many other families that exist that you may not have heard of, because, you know, people have heard of only the ones that are put in front of us. But who are these more shadowy characters whose ideologies and philosophies, intelligent men, highly, highly schooled intelligent men, that the human race needs to know about, who come up with all of this stuff?
Well, we could talk about this all night, and because it's quite a fascinating subject, and I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, and you know, make sure that you get one of the first copies of the new DVD, and that'll make another great interview. You know, I really want to. We're finishing that up now, and we're absolutely sure that we'll send you one off.
Okay,
we're really enthusiastic
great.
About it.
Thank you.
It.
I'll look forward to that.
Yep. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it, Kent, and good luck with all the projects you're doing.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. You have a good evening, and I'll be in touch soon.
You too, my friend. Bye-bye.
Okay. Good night.